Shalom Harabarnix. Welcome to our next session in our study of the First Regathering, Zionism in Modern Israel. This is session 17, dealing with Israel present. So let's review where we were last session. Last session, we began with UN Security Council Resolution 242. It was designed to bring peace between Israel and the Arab nations that had attacked her. Resolution 242 accomplished nothing. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was founded. Yasser Arafat became the leader of the PLO. In 1968, Israel was involved in a war of attrition with Egypt. Now, this is a summary of the war of attrition in Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. I will read the information in this box for you. On the 26th of October 1968, the Egyptians opened fire at Israeli positions on the east bank of the Suez Canal, and 10 Israelis died. On October 31st, 1968, the first Israeli counter-raid began. Israel begins construction of the Bar Lev fortified line. On 8th of March, 1969, the Egyptians again opened fire. Firing continues every few days, and also the Egyptian commando raids were ordered across the canal. On the 20th of July, 1969, the Israeli Air Force begins raids on Egyptian military targets along the canal. And then in January of 1970, the Israeli Air Force began raids on military targets deep inside Egypt. On the 7th of August, 1970, both sides decide to call it quits. Israel and Egypt agree to a ceasefire, and no territory had changed hands. It just simply wasn't going to work. It wasn't worth it for either side. Golda Meir became the Prime Minister of Israel. In 1973, Israel was embroiled in the Yom Kippur War. President Anwar Sadat had done a good job of lulling Israel into complacency. The Israelis didn't dream that he would ever want to attack them and try to win back the Sinai by force. Anwar Sadat enlisted Syrian President Hafez al-Assad on his side. So now we had a two-front war set up, the North Syria and the South Egypt. And it took place with a surprise attack on Yom Kippur, October 6th. Here are some Egyptian Su-7 fighters heading for the Sinai to conduct raids on the Bar Lev line. To the north, we'll start with the north. We'll start in the war on the northern frontier. This is the Golan Heights and the location of Damascus. Initially, the Syrians penetrated deep into the Golan Heights by virtue of their surprise attack. The Israeli response was slow in coming, but it was effective, and they eventually pushed the Syrians back to the ceasefire lines. But then the Israelis continued on beyond the ceasefire lines and took their aim at Damascus, pulling up their attack and their advance 22 miles from the Syrian capital. So Israel was very successful in the northern front. On the southern front, the Egyptians had opened up with a tremendous air and artillery barrage all along the 110 miles of the Suez Canal. After an intense artillery barrage, the Egyptian troops came over on boats, and then the Egyptians penetrated into the Sinai a good number of miles, very successful. So we have the northern front and the Israelis penetrating into Syrian territory, and we have the southern front with the Egyptians penetrating into Israeli-occupied territory. The Egyptians then launched a mechanized attack toward the center of the Sinai. It was a tremendous tank battle, and the Israelis decimated the Egyptian forces, and they turned tail for the canal. This battle also opened up a seam between north and southern segments of the Egyptian army. This seam was taken advantage of through Operation Gazelle. Ariel Sharon and his forces would cross the canal first and secure the landing on the other side. That would be followed by Adon's forces, who would come across and turn south to surround the southern part of the Egyptian army from the west. And then Magan's forces would come in, and they would turn east to destroy the supply lines. And it was very successful. The southern aspect of the Egyptian army was soon surrounded and had to surrender. So this is the results of the Yom Kippur War. Israel proper is in the yellow, that remained untouched. Israel's occupied territory in the light brown remained untouched. In 1973, the Egyptians gained a little bit of territory along the east bank of the Suez Canal. That was the only losses the Israelis suffered. But the Israelis had gained territory on the west side of the canal in Egypt. Ben Gurion died in 73, and here is his grave beside his wife on their kibbutz of Sedeh Boker. We move to 1975 and UN Resolution 3379, which pronounced Zionism was racism. That was repealed in 1991. We finished up with Operation Entebbe. Some terrorists hijacked an Airbus A300, an Air France Airbus A300, and flew it to Uganda, Entebbe, Uganda. And there they separated the Jewish and Israeli passengers, allowed the non-Israeli and non-Jewish passengers to leave, and threatened the Jewish and Israeli passengers with death. Therefore, Israel decided on a rescue operation. Here is Israel to the north, and then almost directly south is Uganda, some 2,500 miles. The operation was conceived, planned in a week, and then the Israeli forces flew 2,500 miles and did rescue the vast majority of the hostages. I believe only three of the hostages suffered were killed during the crossfire. All right, that brings us to the new material. And we come to 1977, and the Likud comes to power. Amid the turmoil of contending parties, the 1977 electoral campaign gave every appearance of following earlier precedents. It would turn into a contest between three major blocs. The largest bloc was the labor-dominated Alignment. The other end of the political spectrum was the conservative Likud under the leadership of Menachem Begin. Finally, there were the religious parties. Labor members such as Yigal Alon and Abba Iban favored a substantial Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Menachem Begin, however, perceived of an undivided land of Israel. When the votes were counted, Likud was have found to increase its Knesset representation from 39 to 43 seats. The National Religious Party had enlarged its delegation from 10 to 12 seats, and the Labor had lost one-third of its strength. Never before in Israel's history had there been such a shift away from the Labor Party. In 1977, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat visited Jerusalem. The shift in Israel's political and economic course in 1977 was prefigured by a striking and no means dissimilar reorientation in Egypt. There were three factors for this reorientation. Number one was Sadat. Anwar Sadat organized and orchestrated the change personally. With his reputation at new heights following the Yom Kippur War, the Egyptian president felt secure enough to embark on a far-reaching overhaul of Egyptian society, a liberalization in all fields. The new liberalization, of course, affected the economic field. Sadat wanted to introduce Western-style capitalism. He knew this could only be achieved through peace. Now, to foster his vision of a national revival, Sadat made the calculated decision in June of 1975 to open the Suez Canal. Sadat insisted that economic viability could not be reconciled with the burden of remaining on a perpetual war footing, that is, keeping 700,000 men under arms, keeping 700,000 men in the military. The successful military crossing of the canal appeared to fortify the nation's desire for peace. With their honor restored, that's because they could now reopen the canal and they had territory on the east bank of the canal that was had been recaptured. With their honor restored, the Egyptian people found less humiliation in contemplating a new relationship with the enemy. Sadat explained his approach succinctly in his autobiographical work, In Search of Identity. Now here's the cover of that book. You're interested in reading about Anwar Sadat's perspective, you can pick it up on Amazon.com. In Search of Identity. There he wrote, We have recovered our pride and self-confidence after the October 1973 battle, just as our armed forces did. We are no longer motivated by complexes, whether defeatist inferiority ones or those born out of suspicion and hate. And this is why the opposing sides met soon after the battle dust had settled to talk matters over. With the fighting over, we harbored nothing but respect for one another. Factor number two was the inauguration of a new administration in Washington. This added unique momentum to the search for Middle East peace. Jimmy Carter entered the White House in January of 1977. As he evaluated his future course, Sadat was presented with an unexpected opening by the Israelis. It happened that upon forming his cabinet, Menachem Begin had astonished his colleagues and the nation at large by his choice of foreign minister. The foreign minister was factor number three, Moshe Dayan. So we have factor number one was Anwar Sadat, factor number two is Jimmy Carter, and now factor number three is Moshe Dayan. Now, upon assuming office, Begin shared an interest in a trade-off. What he had in mind was an Israeli free hand in Judea and Samaria for a state of non-belligerency with Egypt. Dayan, with his record as a dove in Sinai and a hawk on the West Bank, would be indispensable to Begin in selling the idea of such a trade-off first to Egypt and then to Israel. Begin set about dispatching signals to Cairo of his willingness to strike a deal. We'll give you Sinai, you give us the West Bank. Such a deal. Such a deal. Dayan ordered the draft of a possible Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The paper was sent off to Washington for examination. U.S. endorsement was regarded as indispensable leverage with the Arab enemy. As Dayan hoped, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and his advisors were impressed enough to request the president's personal intervention with the Egyptians, and Carter agreed. On September 10, 1977, the document was sent to Cairo, followed by a private letter from Carter to Sadat. The president asked Sadat to test Begin's sincerity. At that point, in May 1977, General Yitzhak Hofi, director of the Mossad, uncovered information about a Libyan assassination plot against Sadat. Begin decided to convey the information to the Egyptians. "That may warm the atmosphere between us," he suggested, and he was right. Now, Morocco's King Hassan was regarded as a valuable conduit for the information. In June of 1977, convinced that the moment for peace was ripe, Hassan was prepared to serve as an intermediary. He proved to be an effective one. Through the Moroccan ambassador in Cairo, the Egyptians were informed that Israel possessed vital security information. Inasmuch as the data could only be transmitted directly, not through intermediaries, the king arranged for a meeting in Casablanca between General Hofi and Egypt's Director of Military Intelligence, Lieutenant General Kamal Hassan Ali. Hassan Ali was stunned by the detailed evidence the Israeli brought with him, including names and addresses of the Palestinian assassins in Cairo. Acting on the information, the Egyptian secret police seized the conspirators with extensive incriminating documents and weapons, and Sadat was genuinely grateful. The idea had warmed the atmosphere between Israel and Egypt. On November 9, 1977, Sadat announced he was willing to go to the Israeli parliament and discuss the Israeli withdrawal from Sinai. The impact of that statement was stunning. In Israel, Begin was astounded. He had anticipated private talks, but a public ceremonial visit by an Egyptian president to Jerusalem, the whole idea seemed incredible. The Prime Minister was on the state radio the next day, issuing an open invitation to Sadat to come to Israel. 5 days later, in a note communicated through the U.S. embassies in Tel Aviv and Cairo, Begin formally and officially invited the Egyptian leader to address the Knesset on November 20th. Sadat accepted on the spot. On November 20th, 1977, Sadat faced the Knesset with a 40-minute address. In his speech, Sadat offered Israel the inducement that its people had been waiting for 30 years. Here's what he said. In all sincerity, I tell you that we welcome you among us with full security and safety. We used to reject you. We had our reasons and our fears, yes. But I declare to the whole world that we accept living with you in permanent peace based on justice. Today, through my visit to you, I ask you, why do we not stretch out our hands with faith and sincerity so that together we might remove all suspicion of fear, betrayal, and bad intentions? Upon his return, Sadat's reception in Cairo was tumultuous. Nearly a million people cheered him in his open car journey from the airport. However, initial discussions were agonizing for both sides, and soon Egypt and Israel were at an impasse. And this leads to the 1978 Camp David Accords. It was this very lack of success that brought into play a critical procedural agreement between the Israelis and the Egyptians. Sadat and Begin consented to discuss their outstanding differences jointly with President Jimmy Carter at the presidential retreat of Camp David. It would take place at the urgent request of Jimmy Carter himself. Aware that the two Middle Eastern governments were reaching a possible irreconcilable standoff, the American president was determined that the momentum for peace between them would now have to be restored, if necessary, by exercising the fullest political influence of the most powerful country in the world. On September 5, 1978, Sadat and Begin arrived at Camp David. Eventually, after hard and emotional negotiations, two agreements were hammered out. One was entitled, A Framework for Peace in the Middle East, and the other, A Framework for the Conclusion of a Peace Treaty between Egypt and Israel. Now, the arrangements were good for both sides. The Egyptians were guaranteed the return of their land, all of it. The Israelis would gradually return all of the Sinai to Egypt, and normalized relations between the two countries would gradually phase in as well. A three-stage negotiation framework for the Palestinian problem in all its aspects was outlined as well. The Camp David Accords represented an impressive diplomatic breakthrough for each of the participants. On September 17, 1978, a televised ceremony of signing took place in the White House. And here is that signing of the Camp David Accords. President Carter himself observed that a formal peace treaty between Egypt and Israel would be negotiated and completed within the next 3 months. The road to peace now seemed dramatically shorter. Sadat was a hero when he arrived home. In late November, the 1978 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded jointly to Sadat and Begin. But a hair-raising road to peace still remained. The initial euphoria died away in Egypt, and serious opposition surfaced regarding the Camp David Accords. Bowing to the pressure, Sadat altered his understanding of the agreement. By December, when the peace treaty was originally scheduled to be signed, the likelihood of peace appeared very, very dim. So now we move to 1979, and the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty is signed. In March 1979, President Carter, in an act of desperation, decided to travel personally to Egypt and Israel in an effort to achieve a final breakthrough. In a hectic 5 days of negotiations in Cairo and in Jerusalem, concluded with a peace treaty. On March 22, 1979, by a margin of 95-18, Israel's parliament voted to ratify the peace pact. 4 days later, March 26, 1979, in a White House ceremony, Sadat and Begin placed their signatures on a formal treaty of peace between the two nations. And here's a very, very well-known photograph of that moment. Now, the document terminated the state of war between Egypt and Israel. Israel undertook to withdraw all its armed forces from the Sinai. Egypt pledged itself to use Israel's evacuated airfields in the Sinai Peninsula exclusively for civilian, not military purposes. Each party agreed to respect each other's sovereignty, territorial integrity, political independence, and its right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries. Each undertook to conduct normal diplomatic, economic, and cultural relations with each other, and to remove all discriminatory barriers to free movement between people and goods. All right, let's move to 1981. Iraq's nuclear reactor is destroyed by the Israeli Air Force. In 1974, the Saddam Hussein government, and here's President Saddam Hussein, the Saddam Hussein government in Iraq began making plans to go nuclear. Saddam Hussein set about promoting his own brand of pan-Arab socialism throughout the Middle East through subversion and terror. Those close to the man regarded him as the logical heir to Gamal Abd al-Nasser, who was the former president of Egypt. Saddam intended to widen his influence, as Nasser never had, by becoming the first Arab leader to commit to command a nuclear arsenal. Iraq was able to rely on cooperation from France. By 1978, however, misgivings were developing even within the French Foreign Ministry. The French contract with Iraq promised delivery not only of two nuclear plants, but of nuclear fuel enriched with uranium-235. The fuel was to be shipped in 6 installments of 13 kilos each, with the entire consignment to be delivered by 1981. This was sufficient uranium for the manufacture of 9 weapons. The Israelis decided to adopt vigorous countermeasures of their own. In April 1979, saboteurs broke into the warehouse near Toulon and blew up the casings for Iraq's first reactor. The components had been scheduled for shipment that week. New casings were delivered in the autumn of 1979, and the first installment of enriched uranium reached Iraq in June of 1980. After 3 more shipments, the Iraqis would be able to irradiate enough fuel from their reactor to produce weapons-grade plutonium. In mid-1980s, the Saddam Hussein regime would be expected to possess a stockpile of at least 6 atomic bombs. One way or another, Saddam Hussein's nuclear program had to be stopped. Menachem Begin desired an aerial bombardment of the Osirik reactor. Now, the raid was sent for June 7th. Preparations began and continued through the winter and spring of 1981. On June 7th, 1981, at 4 p.m., 8 Israeli F-16s took off from their base. The planes were provided with extra fuel tanks and special bomb racks that carried 2 2,000-pound MK-84 iron bombs. And here is the F-16A that was so important in Israel's air arm. And here is an F-16A. This is the one flown by Colonel Ilan Ramon, the 8th and last F-16 to drop its bombs on the reactor. Now, we have a little insignia on the side of the aircraft located right here. Let's go in for a close look. There in the triangle is the insignia of Operation Opera. So this aircraft was involved in Operation Opera. Now, once airborne, the F-16s moved into formation with an escort of 6 F-14 fighter interceptors, and this is the F-14 Tomcat. This one has American markings on it. It's in its swept wing position. It's a movable wing aircraft. The swept back wing is for high speed movement, and then when the wings are expanded, for lower speed movement. So that's the F-14 Tomcat that went along as an escort. The Israelis also readied an unknown number of other planes, including F-15s, equipped with oversized tanks to provide aerial refueling. And this is the F-15 aircraft that was part of Israel's air arm. The trip would cover more than 1,000 miles to the target and back, and that distance would stretch the F-16s to the limit. And any deviation from the plan, any battle with enemy planes would require additional fuel, and refueling would take place over Arab territory. No room for error existed. The main force of 8 F-16s and 6 F-15s, accordingly, headed east across the Gulf of Aqaba, along the northern width of the Saudi Arabia, near the border with Jordan. Military intelligence had selected the route after identifying certain radar blind spots. The attack group flew in tightly bunched formations that projected a radar signature of a large commercial aircraft. that hopefully would fool the Arab radar operators. Crossing Saudi and Jordanian airspace into Iraq, the plane sped on past Baghdad to Tuwaita and approached low to avoid detection. One of the F-15s initially overflew the Osirik reactor to draw anti-aircraft fire. Meanwhile, the F-16 swept up into the sky to allow the pilots to aim, and with the setting sun behind them, they dived into the target, sending the bombs hurtling against the reactor's concrete and lead protective dome. And here's a drawing of an F-16 on its dive, releasing its bombs destined for the nuclear reactor's dome. The tactic had been refined during months of practice against a mock-up in the Sinai Desert. The first bombs were fitted with delayed action fuses, allowing them to penetrate the dome and then explode, opening gaping holes in the side of the dome. The next bombs struck only moments later, finding those holes with stupefying accuracy, in the words of a French observer. The bombs destroyed the reactor inside. One French technician was killed in the attack. Iraqi anti-aircraft fire spattered harmlessly, and all Israeli planes returned safely. This was a five-hour operation. And here is an overview of Operation Opera. Step one, in 1555, the aircraft take off from the Etzion Air Base. Step two, the aircraft fly over King Hussein's yacht as they went over the Gulf of Aqaba. Ironically, they went right over King Hussein's yacht. So he must have figured out something was up. Step three, 1735, eight F-16 fighters strike the reactor. And then step four, the aircraft return at high altitude and land at the Etzion Air Base at 1900. So we had a totally successful operation. Was the raid justified? From all evidence, the Iraqis were indeed moving towards the production of atomic weaponry. The airstrike's diplomatic fallout was far-reaching. President Reagan at first condoned and then criticized the attack, both in official statements and in his support of UN Security Council resolution of condemnation. A scheduled shipment of F-16 aircraft to Israel was halted. Israel's violation of Saudi airspace multiplied Saudi appeals for effective radar protection. And so publicly, the entire world complained against the Israelis. But you know, privately, they said, thank you. Thank you for what you did. Now, if the air attack reaped criticism on the international scene, there was one area at least in which Begin achieved substantial success, and that was in Israel itself. Here, news of the bombing evoked widespread admiration as a legitimate act of self-defense. The sheer audaciousness of the raid, no less than the brilliance of its execution, visibly enhanced the Prime Minister's political standing only days before the Knesset election. Let's move to 1982, and Israel's withdrawal from the Sinai is completed. Here is a map of the withdrawal. Israel proper is the light blue. The occupied territories are the dark blue. Then we have the interim drawback in 1975, followed by a redeployment in 1980 to about two-thirds of the Sinai Peninsula, and then a final redeployment in 1982. Each deployment gave Egypt back approximately one-third of the Sinai territory until they were in possession of their entire territory once again. All right, let's move to Operation Peace for Galilee. Early in June of 1982, Israel's border with the neighboring Arab countries was reasonably quiet. The southern frontier with Egypt was altogether in a state of peace. Now, the West Bank trembled with barely suppressed ferment, and infiltration from Jordan at least had ended. By 1970, that was over. So there's a little bit of concern about the West Bank, but there's no problem with Jordan. In the northeast, Syria remained irredeemably hostile, but not a single episode of truce violation had occurred along the Golan since the 1974 disengagement agreement. Not even since Israel's annexation of this critical buffer plateau in December of 1981. Therefore, Menachem Begin's attention was transfixed by Lebanon, the smallest and weakest of Israel's neighbors. Throughout May and June of 1981, the Israeli Air Force periodically attacked guerrilla positions in Lebanon. Because of Lebanon's weakness, guerrillas had forced themselves in and had taken up positions along the northern border with Lebanon. When the guerrillas lashed back with a rocket barrage against Nahariya, a middle-sized northern Israeli town, Air Force jets escalated the level of violence and a heavy retaliatory bombardment of PLL headquarters in Beirut, killing some 100 people and wounding at least 600 others. You see, the PLO had, in effect, set up a quasi-semi-government in Lebanon. Lebanon was too weak to resist them. And so they had started an army. They had begun an army in southern Lebanon, and they were harassing Israel from southern Lebanon. And here is a map of Operation Peace for Galilee. Here is southern Lebanon at the north. And this is the location of Nahariya, beautiful little town nestled in the northwest corner of the Israeli territory, right up against the Lebanese border. So the guerrillas, the PLO, bombarded Nahariya. The Israelis retaliated by bombing PLO headquarters in Beirut. Thereupon, the PLO launched an even more prolonged Katyusha rocketing of Galilee settlements. And this is the type of rocket they used, the Katyusha rocket purchased from Russia, I believe, a Russian rocket, bombing the Galilee settlements. The PLO leadership subsequently built their frontline strength in southern Lebanon to an equivalent of 5 infantry brigades, about 15,000 soldiers. So this was a guerrilla army. This was no ragtag bunch of rebels here. This was now a guerrilla army. The PLO force could increase Katyusha and artillery salvos. They could increase the Fedayun raids. They could increase amphibious forays against Israel's 63 Galilee settlements and coastal towns. That was all the potential that was developing in southern Lebanon. For Chief of Staff Eitan, the evidence was compelling that only a larger scale military operation could eradicate the danger. Here's General Rafael Eitan. The catalyst for the invasion was provided from an unexpected site. On June 30th, 1982, the De La Rue Group, this was a British publishing and printing conglomerate, held a banquet in London's Dorchester Hotel. There were 400 guests. These guests included industrialists and several ambassadors. One of the ambassadors was Shlomo Argov of Israel. When the banquet ended, Argov left the hotel shortly before 11 p.m. A young Palestinian, Hassan Saeed, carrying a shoulder bag, had been loitering on the street outside for nearly an hour. As the ambassador entered his limousine, Saeed removed a submachine gun from the bag and fired one shot from a distance of 15 feet. Argov was struck in the head and collapsed. He survived, but was paralyzed. The following day, the Israeli Air Force began massive bombardment of PLO targets in Lebanon, battering arms depots and military camps the entire distance up to Beirut. The reaction of individual PLO factions was to launch sporadic shelling of Israeli settlements in the Galilee. In an emergency cabinet meeting on June 5th, Begin insisted that the army would have to strike immediately to activate a long-prepared strategy of clearing a 25-mile-wide strip along the Lebanese border. If this was accomplished, the PLO's artillery would be pushed decisively beyond range of Israel's northern settlements. Assurance was given that Beirut was not an objective. The undertaking, Operation Peace for Galilee, would be completed within 2 or 3 days. The cabinet then gave its approval. So did Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin of the Labor Party when they were informed by Begin. On June 6, 1982, three Israeli divisions closed in on the Palestinians from all sides. Up the coastal road, amphibious forces landed near Sidon and Damour. A division was sent into the central sector through the Shuf Mountains. An advance was rapid. And this was the first time the PLO had used children in battle. And those are personal comments that were made to me when I was in Israel as a volunteer with the IDF, with their Sar-El program. We had evening lectures by various IDF soldiers, and Major Israel Isaac briefed us on Operation Peace for Galilee. He was involved in that operation, and as you can see, he was wounded quite severely in that operation. But he stated that this was the first time the PLO began using children in battle. On the third day, June 8th, Israeli troops were already beyond the 25-mile security zone that had been declared the objective of Operation Peace for Galilee. On June 7th, Israel troops attacked Syrian units in Jezin, a junction controlling access to the southern Baca Valley. It was a costly full-scale battle. Calling up reinforcements, the Syrians launched heavy counterattacks of their own. They inflicted serious casualties on the Israelis, whose armored column was stopped in its tracks. Air supremacy was vital, and here no alternative existed but to strike directly against the SAM missile batteries placed in the valley. Ariel Sharon, the defense minister, argued that bombardment of the missiles was necessary to minimize Israeli casualties in the Lebanese coastal zone. Begin supported the argument. After a brief hesitation, the cabinet members approved the attack with the understanding that they also had endorsed a major ground operation against the powerful Syrian army. On June 9th, the Israelis launched their attack. Wave after wave of planes came over, F-15s flying top cover, F-16s carrying bombs, and a Hawkeye command plane that was crowded with electronic gear directing operations and jamming the Syrian radar. The SAMs were launched by the Syrians. They failed to register a single hit. Conversely, 17 of the 19 missile batteries were knocked out by Israeli bombs. The following day, another wave of Israeli jets finished the job, destroying the remaining SAM batteries. Almost as costly for the Syrians was the beating taken by their own air force. During the first Israeli attack on the missiles, the Syrians came out with their MiG-25 interceptors. And this is the MiG-25 Foxbat, purchased from Russia. These are Russian markings on this Foxbat. And here's a photograph of a MiG-25 on display on the ground. So the Israelis shot down 22 of these Foxbats without a loss. The next day, in the second attack, another 24 Syrian jets were destroyed, again without Israeli losses. In the ensuing days, nearly 50 additional Syrian fighters would be downed without cost to the Israelis. As early as the night of June 9 and 10th, the Israeli Air Force was free to ravage the Syrians on the ground. It was after these 48 hours of disaster that the Syrians decided to pull out of active fighting entirely. Despite the loss of SAM missiles and ultimately more than 100 planes, the Assad regime understood that the war was being fought in Lebanon, not in Syria, and that the Israelis were not interested in penetrating into Syrian territory. The war suddenly appeared much more far-reaching than the Israeli cabinet or the Israeli people were led to anticipate, and so it did to the great powers as well. In the morning of June 10th, President Reagan dispatched an urgent message to Begin, pointing out that Israel's incursion into Lebanon already far transcended Jerusalem's original announced purpose. Israel would have to accede to a ceasefire immediately, the president warned. The prime minister and his cabinet agreed to a ceasefire for noon the next day on June 11th. The Israeli government ignored Yasser Arafat's announced willingness to participate in the June 11th truce, observing that his guerrilla force was not a responsible government but a band of terrorists. Emphasizing the point, Israeli forces on June 12th, launched into a sustained air, land, and sea bombardment of Palestinian strongholds south and west of Beirut. On June 13, several key objectives of Operation Peace for Galilee had been reached. The PLO infrastructure south of Beirut had been destroyed. The Syrians had been soundly thrashed, if not evicted, from Lebanon. And here is a summary of Operation Peace for Galilee, again from Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. It just indicates the Israeli advance through southern Lebanon up to Beirut. The Israelis dominated southern Lebanon at this point. And so they had captured now vast quantities of PLO equipment. After inventory was completed in October, the list of PLO material included 1,320 armored combat vehicles, among them several hundred obsolete tanks, 82 artillery pieces, 62 Katyusha rocket launchers, 215 mortars, 196 anti-aircraft guns, 1,342 anti-tank weapons, 33,000 small arms, and thousands of pieces of communications equipment. As I said, the PLO was now a small army, no ragtag bunch of rebels, no ragtag bunch of terrorists, a small army. Jerusalem contended that the destruction of the PLO in South Lebanon was an act of liberation. And the claim seemed borne out by local Arab reaction to the Israeli invasion. Foreign journalists confirmed that the inhabitants of South Lebanon were euphoric at the destruction of the Palestinian guerrilla forces. Shia Muslims and Christians alike vied with each other for welcoming Israeli troops and inviting Israeli officers into their homes. When the Israeli army detained 9,000 PLO suspects, Christian and Shia villagers eagerly helped in the task of identification. The cost to the Palestinians, PLO fighters, and non-combatants alike was quite terrible. Estimates later put the number of Palestinian dead in South Lebanon's refugee camps at over 6,000. Israeli troops who entered these complexes afterward were aghast at the carnage wreaked by the bombardments. They were shocked, too, by the vindictiveness of the Christian and Shia authorities, who refused Red Cross permission to set up tent shelters for Palestinian victims. Israel lost 130 dead and 600 wounded. News of the losses sent off widening tremors of concern in Israel. Even then, no one would have anticipated that far worse was yet to come. And now we come to Operation Big Pines. After a week of war, Israel's army was in effective occupation of southern Lebanon. Its tanks and self-propelled guns surrounded Beirut, trapping some 15,000 Palestinian guerrillas intermingled in the western part of the city among a 500,000 Muslims. Now was the time for Ariel Sharon to set in motion Operation Big Pines, his carefully guarded master plan for smashing the PLO infrastructure in Beirut. In Sharon's scenario, the destruction of the PLO quasi-government in Lebanon, you see, Lebanon was so weak that the PLO was able to dominate the country. So in Sharon's scenario, the destruction of the PLO quasi-government in Lebanon would shatter Yasser Arafat's influence among the inhabitants of the West Bank. It was an audacious scheme, one that far transcended the officially proclaimed goal of Operation Peace for Galilee. Now was the moment, too, under the protection of Israeli air and artillery power, for the Falangist forces to send their militias directly into West Beirut and complete the rout of the PLO. Now, the Falangist forces are the militia of the Lebanese Falange political party. And this is where the arrangements hung fire. Despite heavy pressure from Sharon, the Falangist leadership refrained from military action. The Israeli command soon faced a painful decision. Their troops had pushed too far to leave the PLO enclave intact. Yet the notion of moving directly into the city and using troops in bitter street fighting was unacceptable. Accordingly, after a few days of hesitation, General Eitan and his staff came up with an alternative, one that gained cabinet approval. It was to uproot the PLO guerrillas by siege, by heavy aerial and artillery bombardment, and by halting munitions and food supplies. During the next 2 months, some 400 Israeli tanks and 1,000 guns poured salvo after salvo into West Beirut. For the first time in the nation's long series of wars against the Arabs, Israel's air force bombed an enemy capital systematically. By the first week in July, some 500 buildings had been destroyed by shells and bombs. In the world's first manhunt by air, the Israelis also nearly succeeded in killing Arafat. On four different occasions, with information provided by their own spies and by local informers, they bombed or rocketed targets less than an hour after Arafat's departure. He escaped by the skin of his teeth four times. As Sharon had hoped, the pulverizing siege rapidly became unendurable for the Palestinian guerrillas. In late June, Arafat let it be known that he was prepared to withdraw his men from the city if appropriate terms and guarantees could be worked out. The Israelis rejected all qualifications. To intensify the pressure, Israeli troops on August 4, 1982, took over Beirut's international airport and then began inching forward selectively in the western part of the city. The Air Force, meanwhile, carried out its single heaviest bombing of the war, 127 sorties in 10 hours. Simultaneously, naval vessels offshore joined in the bombardment, launching Gabriel missiles into West Beirut. Arafat was completely unnerved by then. It wasn't Israel's hard stance alone that eroded his confidence, but where would his troops go? Not a single Arab country was willing at the first to offer Palestinians sanctuary. Eventually, a number of Arab countries were willing to parcel out the guerrillas around a number of countries, throughout a number of countries. On August 12th, Sharon ordered an unprecedented saturation bombing of West Beirut. It continued for nearly a day and killed nearly 300 people. On August 12th, the saturation bombing took place on August 12th, and it inflicted a particularly severe blow on Israel's image in the democratic world. Western newspaper and television reportage gave a sharply biased account of the war, accepting PLO figures of Lebanese and Palestinian dead and wounded. Journalists drew analogies between the genocide of Beirut and the genocide of Warsaw in World War II. Finally, an evacuation of PLO troops was scheduled to begin August 21, 1982, and to end September 4th. Remarkably, all went according to plan. PLO troops were hooted and jeered by thousands of Christian Lebanese onlookers. The long years of PLO intimidation and terrorism appeared to be ending. During those 12 days, some 14,000 Palestinian and Syrian fighters were evacuated from the capital, either by sea or overland, on the Beirut-Damascus Highway. And as I said, they were evacuated and distributed among a number of countries. Now, this map summarizes the end of the Lebanese war. After the war, we see that Syria is in control. Remember, Lebanon is very weak. And so Syria is in control of northern Lebanon. That's the green. Christian groups are the purple. They're in control of other areas of the country. Israel is in control of the yellow area, southern Lebanon, most of southern Lebanon, right up to Beirut. And then the United Nations was brought into control, the area south of Israel. Now, Israel withdrew from Lebanon. Eventually, they withdrew entirely from southern Lebanon. But slowly, over the years, border attacks resumed, only now by Hezbollah. So let's examine Hezbollah. Here is the Hezbollah flag and symbol, insignia. Now, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Hezbollah, Its Identity and Goals. This was edited directly from the Hezbollah.org website. I want to read you three sections, two paragraphs and one sentence from this website.
It was not by sheer coincidence that Hezbollah turned into a struggle movement against the Israeli occupation. Because Hezbollah's ideological ideals see no legitimacy for the existence of Israel. So that's the first thing we learn. Israel has no right to exist in Hezbollah's eyes. And the conflict becomes one of legitimacy that is based on religious ideals. In other words, this is a religious war. And Israel has no right to exist according to our religious ideals. Let's move on. Hezbollah also used one of its own special types of resistance against the Zionist enemy, and that is suicide attacks. Now, that's their own words. So they appear to be claiming that they're the origin of suicide attacks, and they appear to be quite proud of them. Okay, the final paragraph is such hypocrisy and such a line of garbage. On the Hezbollah website, they state, "It should also be clear that the kind of Islam that Hezbollah seeks is a civilized one that refuses any kind of oppression, degradation, subjection, and colonization, that is, of fellow Muslims. If you're not a Muslim, you can be oppressed, degraded, subjected, and colonized. And if you're Jewish, you can be killed, you can be destroyed." So that is a line of garbage there. "Hezbollah also stretches its arm of friendship to all on the basis of mutual self-respect, unless you're not a Muslim. If you're Jewish, we'll destroy you, we'll kill you. If you're an infidel, we'll kill you unless you convert." That's fundamentalist Islam thinking. So this is all a line of hypocrisy and propaganda and garbage. But that's Hezbollah. All right, 1987, Hamas is founded. Here is the Hamas logo. Hamas is an Arabic acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement, meaning zeal. It was created in Gaza by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. There's Sheikh Yassin. The military branch was founded by Salah Shihadeh. In Hamas's worldview, Islamic precepts forbid a Jewish state in the area known as Palestine, and the Jewish people have no legitimate connection with the land of Israel. So they're exact same position of Hezbollah. And listen to this. "And Yasser Arafat is a traitor to the Islamic Palestinian cause." So Yasser Arafat isn't radical enough. He's a compromiser. He's a traitor. So these guys are way out of the ballpark on the radical end of terrorism. "As its covenant proclaims," this is the Hamas covenant, "the land of Palestine is an Islamic trust. It is forbidden to anyone to yield or concede any part of it. Israel will continue to exist until Islam will" what? "Obliterate it." So that's Hamas for you, a radical terrorist group. All right. Now the Intifada begins. The Intifada means shaking off or rebellion or uprising. On December 9th, 1987, an uprising known as the Intifada began in the Gaza Strip. Before too long, it had expanded throughout the Arab-populated areas of the West Bank. There were four reasons for the Intifada. It was led by young Palestinians who, number one, despaired of the prolonged Israeli occupation. Number two, they despaired of the political deadlock between the PLO and Israel. Number three, they were frustrated with both the local Palestinian leadership and that of the PLO, because the PLO has never really helped the rank-and-file Palestinian, right up to today. And number four, in their despair over they were despaired over the failure of the Arab states to resolve their plight. In other words, the Arab states were losing interest and were indifferent to the, quote, Palestinian cause. Now, the snapping point came in December 9th when an Israeli truck ran over four Arab workers from the Gaza region as they returned from work in Israel. 3 days earlier, an Israeli merchant had been stabbed to death in Gaza, and a rumor began. A rumor began among the Arab populace that the traffic accident was really an Israeli attack of revenge. And so, based on this rumor, attacks on Israeli soldiers and civilians commenced. The Arab residents of the West Bank used whatever weapons were available to them. Most of them attacked throwing rocks. Now here is a young Palestinian, and he has a one whale of a slingshot there. He's going to whirl it over his head and send that good-sized rock thundering toward IDF soldiers. So slingshots and rocks were used. Knives, hatchets, gasoline bombs, and even grenades were also brought into play. And here's another photograph of these young men in one of their battles with the Israeli army. Now, the Israeli army struggled to regain control. Israeli troops broke up demonstrations and attacks by using tear gas and then rubber and plastic bullets. Those are non-lethal bullets. Only under extreme provocation was live ammunition brought into play. Under conditions like this, it was inevitable that excesses could occur, and several Israeli soldiers were found guilty of abusing their powers. Israel tried their best to reduce civilian casualties and injuries. The dangers became more acute when stabbing of Jews spread to Jewish urban areas. Arabs accused of collaboration with the authorities suffered murder and mutilation by their fellow Arabs. For example, between January 1999 and April 1993, that's 2.5 years, during those 2.5 years, 151 Israeli soldiers and civilians were killed. 151. But during the Intifada in Palestinian territory, not 151 were killed, but 1,500 Palestinians were killed by their own brethren. 10 times as many Palestinians were killed by their own brethren than were injured by Israeli soldiers and by Israeli soldiers. 10 times were killed by their own brethren. And I should say that only 10 times more than the Israelis suffered casualties. That's the correct way to say it. The Israeli soldiers and civilians killed were 151, but 10 times that amount of Palestinians were killed by their own brethren. Really sad. By April 1993, the fires of the Intifada had all been burned themselves out. I'm sorry for my clumsy way of explaining the difference between Israeli and Palestinian deaths during the First Intifada. All right, we're down to just a couple of minutes here. Let's see if I have enough time for all this. Here's a young Palestinian joining in the Intifada. All right, let's move to 1989 and a 4-point peace initiative proposed by Israel. The onset of the Intifada in December 1987 and the decision of the Reagan administration to enter into dialogue with the PLO in December 1988 placed Israel in a difficult position, forcing its government to come up with a new peace plan. The initiative announced on May 14, 1989, called for negotiations with the Palestinians and for an interim agreement based on the Camp David autonomy plan. Remember, that had been drawn up earlier between Begin and Sadat as part of the Egypt-Israel peace treaty. At the end of a 5-year transition period, discussions would be held for the final resolution of these issues. The U.S. welcomed the plan as a very useful step, but both the PLO and King Hussein of Jordan rejected it. On October 8th, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker proposed a 5-point plan of talks between Israel and the Palestinian delegation in Cairo. On November 5th, Israel's inner cabinet gave conditional approval to Baker's 5-point peace initiative, but insisted that the U.S. must provide assurances that there'll be no negotiations with the PLO. However, on October 2nd, 1990, the Iraqi army invaded Kuwait, plunging the world into a crisis that far overshadowed the Arab-Israeli situation. The face of peace would be completely altered in its aftermath. Let me just cover one more short subject here. At that time, there was mass immigration of Soviet Jews into Israel. Popular uprisings, economic collapse, and free elections ousted communist governments in most of Eastern Europe from 1989 to 1990. A failed hardline coup against Soviet President Gorbachev led to the suspension of the Communist Party in the USSR and the country's subsequent disintegration in 1991. Today, Russia is governed by the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and this is Vladimir Putin's opinion of the event. The collapse of the Soviet Union was a major geopolitical disaster of the century. Well, that's his view of it, not the view of a lot of other people. However, the collapse of the Soviet Union resulted in a massive Jewish immigration from the Soviet Union starting in 1989. In 1993, the number of Soviet immigrants had totaled 420,000. The peak years were between 1990 and 1991. Here's an immigrant count of the Soviet immigration. 1989, 12,932. And then the immigration began in 1990, 185,227. It reached its peak in 1991 with 147,839 immigrants, and then dropped off in 1992 to 65,093, for a total of over 420,000 Soviet immigrants. So Russian Jewish immigration has had a big impact on Israel, starting with the Chovev Tzion way back in the late 1870s, right up to the present day. The Russian Aliyah of the early 90s was a mixed blessing, however. The blessing, thousands of new Jewish immigrants. The drawback, lots of Russian vices came into the country. The mafia and prostitution, for example. All right, we are now out of time. So we'll pick it up next session in 1991 with the Gulf War. So we'll see you then. Thanks so much for being our students. We're always happy to have you attend our classes. Thanks again. Lehi Thraot. Lehi Thraot.